you're here for a reason. These people need you. The team needs you. You need the team. And these guys are relying on you to help keep them safe when, you know, they're trying to do their job.
Welcome back to the World Extreme Medicine Podcast with myself, Owen Walker. In this episode, I've got Jamie Patterson with me talking about his reflections on the recent earthquake in Morocco for UK ISAR. So the earthquake was one of the strongest to hit Morocco in the last 120 years. So hundreds of aftershocks have been recorded, with the highest being at 5.9 magnitude. So 59,000 homes were damaged and 19,000 homes were completely destroyed. So the earthquake's depth was 11.5 miles away and the epicenter was 44 miles northwest of Marrakesh. So here we are just going to talk really about the anatomy of the deployment, what it felt like on the ground for Jamie and much more. Jamie, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Owen. Thanks for having me. Nice to see you.
Good to see you as well. Jamie, I just wanted to maybe start off by asking you, this was your first deployment in an overseas disaster. Could you maybe just unpack the initial emotions and indeed the process of getting you and the team to Morocco?
I'm pretty new to the team. I joined the team in September 22, I think. And then, deployed pretty much a year later, September 23. The team deployed three times in 2023. The first to Turkey, which was, very different experience to Morocco. I was in Norway on a trip when that happened, and I couldn't get back to the UK in time to join the team going out there. So I'd already kind of experienced that frustration because, you know, you apply for these things and you go to selection and get in and, you know, you, like any new job, you're raring to go, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, and you want to go and do the job you've been selected for and you've signed up to do. So that was quite frustrating. I remember being out in Norway ice climbing in this like winter wonderland and going through stronger emotions than I thought I would, actually. Being frustrated and a little bit, like I'd let people down and things like that. And then translating that to, that was in February, so translating that to, 6 months later in September, I just finished a course with work. I was up in the north of Scotland in Aberdeen, just about to head climbing for a day in the Cairngorms. And woke up to the headlines on my phone and then the WhatsApp message from the team coordinator, asking for volunteers who can go. So put my hand up and said, I can go. Happily, I was just about to have 2 weeks off work, so it was pretty straightforward for me to sort out professionally. But personally, ringing your family up and sticking in the WhatsApp with your friends and stuff that this has happened and this is what I'm doing now, that raises a lot of questions, I think. I did speak to my bosses at work, who were really, really supportive, which was fantastic, that made everything quite simple. But personally, I think it's more challenging than I really recognised before that. I don't think there probably is, but I don't think there's really a training course you can do on how to explain to your mom that you're going to be deployed to an earthquake zone and it'll be all right when you're not really sure, what's going to happen and, you are at risk, I suppose. So it was a case of getting myself from the north of Scotland via home to pick up my kit. So I've got a bag, essentially a big hold all full of my USAR kit and my ISAR kit to be deployed, because we're on literally a number of hours notice to move. It's not, sort yourself out over the weekend. It's right, we're going at 2 o'clock this afternoon. OK, get yourself to X airport. So yeah, got home, picked my kit up, and then we were tasked to get to Brisenorton, which is obviously the kind of main RAF base in the UK, which is down in Oxford, which is not very close to Aberdeen. So I think it would have been about 500 miles driving altogether. Being sensible, plenty of time to think and reflect about things, ask questions, speak to people on the phone, which I found quite useful actually, because I've got quite a busy life, and when I'm driving, like that's the time when I'm driving, I can just, you know, listen to the radio or think or whatever. So yeah, kind of that time for me was really useful to get my thoughts in order, my life in order, and get sorted, I suppose. Then it was a case of arriving at Brisenorton, where the team had gathered, and quite a strange check-in process for a flight when you've got all of the things on the bag you're not supposed to have on a plane, and they just chuck all your bags on the scale at the same time. It's not like a commercial flight. And then a few hours later, walking up the ramp onto a military transport aircraft and being flown out to Morocco. You know, after a bit of an epic journey and a bit of stress and all of that stuff, getting out to flight, then I wouldn't say it's the most uncomfortable flight I've ever had, but, you know, certainly not business class or anything. Landed in Morocco. I think it was quite late at night, maybe about 11 o'clock local time. And the other half of the team were following us in another plane. So trying to get all the kit off, get organized, go through customs, grab some sleep on the tarmac at Marrakesh Airport, you know, with having kind of been through the media cameras and stuff. When you got there, the British ambassador was there to welcome us, which was really nice. It was a bit of a whirlwind experience, and I suppose you don't really stop to reflect about it until you have got some time in the base of operations, the BOO, or you've got some time when you get home to kind of stop and reflect. And then, going from the airport into a Moroccan military truck, like an infantry truck, which I have to say, we were transported and there was all over up to 2,000 meters in the mountains. And those guys were absolutely fantastic with us, really supportive. Just brilliant, brilliant support from the Moroccans to get us to where we needed to be. And then I was lucky enough to be, we were split into two teams, and I was lucky enough to be in the team that got to get our heads down for a couple of hours. So just chucked a roll mat and a sleeping bag out in the back of the truck. And then at sunrise, we were getting ready to go off for our first taskings for the day. So as far as getting things together and the logistics of that, I think that kind of pulls it all together.
So could you speak to, maybe just panning out for a second, something around more the why the UK government sends these teams into this context, and also maybe around the sort of self-sustaining mandate of the team?
It's an interesting one. I think there is probably a really good like textbook answer for this, but for me, I think that morally and ethically, we are in the top 10 richest countries in the world. We've got a really high standard of living. We have the resources to be able to provide humanitarian response on this level. And I have to say that the UK ISR team is the UK's Fire and Rescue Services international arm. So the every member selected from the Fire and Rescue Service, apart from the medical team, who are selected as an independent medical team, who attach then to the various services. But having worked with these guys, on operations now, I have to say, like, the people I was working with, none of them will accept this, but they are the best in the world at what they do. Some of them quite literally written the book about it, and I think that was really reflected when I was working with them. Like, we have a level of capability in this country and in that service, and I think it's a really good and positive use of resources that we are able to offer this service, I suppose, when the need arises. Obviously, it's government driven, so there are, you know, decisions to be made on an international level. The team won't deploy without being invited by the host country. If we're not invited, that would be not a great political move for anyone. So we must be asked for or requested by the host country, Morocco, requested help from a few countries, and we happen to be on them. And you know, everyone, every person there was more than happy to be there. Like I say, doing the job they want to do, but to just provide that help on an international scale.
So how much of a shift, Jamie, is this from like a run of shifts on an ambulance? You know, the longevity of the deployment, and indeed just the changing pace, the teamwork, and the kind of constraints you're working under, the all or nothingness. Could you maybe speak to how drastically different this is to maybe a 7-to-7 shift on an ambulance?
It's funny because there's probably quite a few similarities. So you clock on an ambulance for the day, and you don't know what you're gonna get, what's gonna happen. You don't have the day planned out, and the deployment's very much like that on a grander scale. You don't know what you're gonna do, you know, find or go to. You get some intelligence and stuff, but that's very similar. And in selection, that uncertainty is kind of built in. You'll get told something's happening at this time and it doesn't happen, or you'll be put on a bus and driven all over and you just don't know what's happening. And during selection, that was kind of, it almost felt a bit familiar to me that, oh, well, nothing's happening now. So, you know, as long as I've got my stuff together and ready to go, then I've got this time to use it. And I think ambulance crews across the country would recognize, across the world would recognize that feeling. You know, eating when you can, and you know, looking after yourself in a way, and looking after everybody else, keeping people, you know, fed, watered, topped up, just making sure that people finish at work site, that everyone's no one's injured, everyone's got water, plenty of water on board, and when someone says no, like offering them a bottle of water anyway, because generally people will take it, and just yeah. I think those two factors are quite similar, but in terms of, I think that any clinician sees personal and familial devastation on pretty much a daily basis. It's the kind of the job we're in, you know, whether you're in an emergency medicine situation and, you know, doing resuscitation, etc., or you're breaking bad news, or dealing with chronic illnesses, or etc. Like, there is that human element of it all, and the big thing about the I think that was there, but it was on just such a huge scale, like going into a whole village which has just been totally destroyed, and the sites that come along with that, when you're looking at a collapsed house on the news, it's a collapsed house. When you're walking through the rubble, it's someone's house. It's someone's personal belongings. That's someone's, clothing or whatever is there. And I think that certainly for me, that hit home a lot. I remember walking through and seeing just like some bits of, looked like child schoolwork, you know, bits of writing or maths which had been marked with a red pen, just lying in the rubble and thinking, you know, this. there's that element and that connection of it. And again, I think that's quite, there's a familiar element of that, but the scale of it was just something else. And I think the other side of it was the there's a moment in there for me about, you know, the the personal safety of it. I remember being on a work site one day, and you know, being in this position, and thinking for about 5-10 minutes, thinking, I do not want to be here. What am I doing here? This is a bit silly. You're out of your depth. Like, this is dangerous. Like, really dangerous. And again, you know, perhaps there is element of that in emergency care and stuff, and ambulance care in the UK, where you have that risk and uncertainty, but you can manage that a lot easier. You're not standing under a house that you don't know whether it's going to collapse. You don't know if it's going to be aftershock, etc. And that, you know, compared to, you know, there's a dog in the house or whatever, that you can manage that risk. Whereas if the earth moves now, that was a bit of a step up in my little planning brain. But again, I think taking a step back and looking around me and looking around at the firefighters who were just getting on doing their job. We had plans, we had risk assessments, everything was a safe system of work. And then kind of realizing that this is what I'm here for, this is what you signed up for, and these people are relying on you to look after them if something does go wrong. So, you know, you either step up or you don't. So that element, I think, again, was a big kind of difference as well. And yeah, there were some long days, there were some boring days where we were waiting for stuff, taskings to come in. We had aftershocks in the night. You know, you have to pull watches at night, so you know, take your shift getting up and walking around the camp and making sure everything's secure and everything's working and topping the generators up. It's like being at work, but for a week straight. So yeah, and it's kind of difficult to complain about a late finish once you've had that. But yeah, but again, the culture, the atmosphere, you know, everyone was there to do their job, but to look after each other as well. And it was a camp at the edge of the Atlas Mountains in this devastating zone, but really a caring atmosphere, I would call it. Everyone's there for each other as well, particularly, I would say.
So if you could just walk us through the training, because you've notioned towards the training and how that kind of mimicked what you'd see in deployments, also dealing with, like, say, risk uncertainty and indeed fatigue, teamwork, and that sense of also a sense of forced failure and how you deal with forced failure, because, like you said, there's many factors which are out of your control. Could you maybe speak, just give listeners an idea of the training, but also whether that really did match up to reality?
I don't think anything in match up to reality, because in reality that there's always that little like note in the back of your mind that what if this, what if that. Whereas in training, it's a bit of exercise like this, because you know this is going to end at some point. Or you're not going to be put in real danger, or put at real risk without it being somewhat managed. And I'm not saying it's not managed out there, but there is elements where we don't have control of this, and this is what we're going to do if this happens. I think the training prepares you for that. My background. When I joined, I was in the SALT team in Scotland, so we were very heavily trained to go into hazardous situations and to, you know, set up safe systems of work in risky situations. My background in mountain rescue, that's essentially what we do, is go where ambulances can't go, provide some medical care and get that person out safely. And the same thing with my work in SAR now, where we'll respond to pretty much whoever, wherever, and we can get them out, you know, with some planning and lots of what if planning, safety briefs, etc. So yeah, I think a wealth of experience was definitely had built a good toolbox for me. I think the elements of being tired, I mean, you know, shifts on an ambulance prepare you pretty well for that. You know, shifts in an ED would prepare you pretty well for that. And it's just about recognizing that, managing it. You know, if you're doing expedition work and you're a medic on that expedition, you get used to, right, my day doesn't finish when we get in the camp. I've got to do this, I've got to do that, I've got to do that thing. And it's just about maintaining that momentum, I think. And I always kind of just, now I kind of reflect on that, and I always just take a second to go, what else can I do for somebody else right now? And just think a little bit more kind of around me rather than about how I'm feeling. It's very easy to think, oh, I'm tired tonight, blah, blah, blah. I don't really want to. I don't want to get up. It's cold this morning, et cetera. But, you know, it's your turn to take the watch, so you have to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning, or otherwise the guy that's on before you will be on longer, and that's, you know, not fair. So, yeah, definitely teamwork in. And I think the biggest part of the whole teamwork element there is just being honest with yourself and people around you as well, like asking questions, which, you know, might be daft questions to you, but I'd rather be asking daft questions than get something wrong, or, you know, put myself at unnecessary risk or anyone else at unnecessary risk. So, yeah, I think there's lots and lots of training within the ISR team, and the selection course was really well built in that it does prepare you for having to make stressful decisions in stressful situations, and applying that in the environment that you're being asked to work in, I think.
Could you speak to just that sense of emotion that you were experiencing? You said, you know, you were on top of a rubble pile and you just had this visceral sense of you didn't want to be there. And then a whole other wave and cross-section of emotion as well. How did you transcend that emotion, Jamie, just to kind of A, calm yourself down, but B, also optimize how you were working?
It's a good question. I think what probably really helped me is that, first of all, I looked around me and I looked at the guys I was with. You know, we're all in oranges, kitted up, and we had to do a job. And I definitely took a sense of pride. Like, I got a lot of energy from that. People are relying on me. I'm part of this team. You know, and most of these people I've never met before in my life. So it's very quickly you form all these bonds and stuff, and it's quite cool in a way. But I think for me, that resilience and management of emotion was reminiscent. So my little sister died a few years ago when she was 16, and she was fit and well, healthy. Had a collapse one day, and long story, and 3 weeks later she passed away. And that experience of that uncertainty and going through, you know, days and nights where you were getting told one thing and then 2 hours later everything would change, and that feeling of unsafety, uncertainty as well, was very similar. And I always refer to the experience of Emily dying as being the worst thing. You see, lots of people talk about, oh, that could be the worst thing that you would ever think would happen. That was the worst thing I never thought would happen. And it's quite difficult to articulate, but I think having had that experience, like, what's worse than that? And I'm not sure, for me, I'm not sure there's a lot worse than that. So I think having that experience and having to manage those feelings and thoughts and emotions for a long time, and dealing with them in an absolute range of different ways over that time and since, probably helped me get through that and just be like, right, this is what I've got in front of me. This is what we're dealing with. And just kind of take a step back and really look at the situations and go, right, what can I control? What can I not control? If an aftershock happens and everything starts moving, what's the plan? And I think once you've got those steps clear in your mind, on top of the bit that, you know, you're here, you're part of this team, you're here for a reason, these people need you, the team needs you, you need the team, and these guys are relying on you to help keep them safe when, you know, they're trying to do their job. That kind of combination of things, coupled with that kind of, that emotional experience in the past, kind of combined into kind of snapping me back and being like, right, we've got a job to do, let's just get on with it. And what will be in a way. It is what it is. I'm kind of famous for saying that these days, but yeah, I think sometimes, you know, you go with the best plans and stuff, but I'm very, very acutely aware now of what's the stuff I haven't thought about. So yes, we've thought about an aftershock and this all moving, but, you know, what about that thing there or the little things you're missing? So it's probably a lot to unpack in that, but in some way and form, that's probably the best answer I could give it.
Absolutely. And, you know, to your point, it's about embracing the unpredictable nature of the scene. And as you were moving through, Jamie, it became apparent that it was almost 100% mortality, and those actually that weren't indeed dead had more minor injuries. But you were very much there for the rescuers as well, as much as you were there for the casualties. Could you speak to the sort of that sense of pathology that you were seeing and how different that was maybe from the Turkey deployment?
So yeah, our role as the UMT, the USAR medical team, is to provide NHS level care, so care that the guys and girls will get in the UK, out on the deployment. So we would take care of them from the work site back to the boo, or indeed to, you know, being repatriated by whatever means that happens. And that's our main role. So that's from emergency care and trauma to, you know, minor injuries and illness. And, you know, you're not there alone. You went there with a multidisciplinary team. We hired in Morocco two doctors, two paramedics, and an advanced care practitioner with a nursing background. Now, you know, Deb Swan, the nurse, has got far more experience than me in, you know, nursing care and looking after people for a long time, you know, pharmaceutical interventions with skin rashes, infections, etc. And if you want to learn some really, really good medicine, like, you know, go and speak to a nurse. I always say this. I'm good at putting some bandages on some you know, bleeding, splinting some fractures, and reducing your pain and getting you out of there. Rescue medicine is my thing. So we all kind of got our part to play, and we play off each other's strengths and combine our strengths as well. So I think I can't really speak to the deployment. I wasn't there. The guys, the team did some fantastic rescues in Turkey, some really, really tremendous work. It made a huge difference. I think that any time there's a humanitarian disaster, from my short experience so far, but again, extended into ambulance care or any, you know, turn up to any victim or casualty, that psychological support and that just humanity, I suppose, and that humanitarian care is probably the biggest element. Even if you have a tremendous rescue and there's lots of technical elements and it's USAR and rope rescue or whatever, that there's still that element of humanitarian care and that compassion that's woven through it. And I really do feel that, don't underestimate the power of just being there for people. I think there's a lot to be said for that. And I think even just that human element into big systems, or somebody makes a 999 or 911 or 112 call, and then you turn up. Like, I always try and kind of take a second and embrace that reaction from people when you arrive, that they're relieved that they think things will be all right now, or things are going to start and get better. And I from my experience in Morocco, I do think, and from what I've heard about Turkey and other deployments, I do think that's a huge element for people. And especially, the Moroccans were putting banners up and signs because they knew where our camp was. We would drive up and down the road every day, going in and out to work sites, and they would, write signs saying thank you, and it's nice to know the world cares, etc. And I think I think it's quite special that a firefighter from South Wales will, stop his life and pick his bag up and come up, across the world to come and help some people out with the skills they've got. So I think that's the biggest pathology I would speak to. That's really important, I think.
I think what you're speaking to there is absolutely the team dynamics and actually the bigger team dynamics around, like you say, in-country indigenous populations, the dynamics of affecting change for them, and indeed even the onlookers and the people that are left without homes and families. But could you speak to how you were dealing with the aftershocks? Because there were some profound aftershocks in from the response. They were saying that hundreds were recorded, 5.9 being the biggest sort of aftershock. What were you doing to sort of either offset or mitigate the danger and risks?
Aftershocks were difficult. So you've got a plan, but you don't know how big it's going to be. You can't predict when they're going to happen. So we were up in a little village called Imiantala, working when an aftershock hit, and having never been an aftershock before that, it was quite strange. It wasn't a case of, oh, it's an aftershock, this is what we're going to do now. It was quite weird because everyone kind of went, what's going on? And then there was like this hive collective mind. Everyone realized what was happening, and then there was a rush to evacuate. With a lot of people getting hit by rocks and falling over and hurt themselves. So fortunately, it wasn't a big one. We have plans in place, but you can't predict what's going to happen there. But I think for me, when it happened, it was quite strange because, as I say, didn't really know what happened. Then everyone kind of collectively realised. And the biggest thing for me was I was stood next to someone pretty senior in my team when it happened, and he didn't move. He just stood there, and there was hundreds of people moving quite fast in quite confined space on uneven ground, rubble, etc. And just that calmness, I think, was quite contagious. I think that was it was almost like it happened. I had this question of what was that? And the answer for that question was, it was an aftershock. It stopped. This is what we're going to do now. Quite calm, quite collected. And I took a massive amount from that. And that was probably one of the best leadership moments I've ever seen, because certainly two or three of us looked at that person for, you know, the guidance. You're in that leadership role, that's the responsibility you kind of take on sometimes. And that was how we dealt with it. And then for me, it was about, oh, okay, well, we've got a job to do then. And I certainly had a job to do in, sorting out some wounds, etc. And treating a few injuries and helping people be evacuated to the Moroccan ambulances, as they would on any, you know, given Tuesday afternoon in Morocco, that this is what would happen. And just kind of doing my best to, you know, augment that where I could, or be an extra pair of hands where I could. The Moroccans, I must say, were all over it. They were fantastic. It was not so much as a mitigation, but a response. And the response was incredibly, I have to say, incredibly professional in its manner.
So just panning back and looking at mental health considerations, you spoke quite candidly, Jamie, just there about your own mental health and your trials and tribulations and some actual, you said this, you know, even when you got the call initially and indeed when you were on the deployments, it maybe twigged things in you didn't expect it to twig and or sort of notion. Could you speak to sort of the training and awareness in mental health that the UK ISAR put into consideration and indeed emphasize and you know, pre and post deployment?
I think again, this is going to be a wider answer than that, because any organization I've worked with, especially this day and age, puts a lot into puts energy and resources into well-being and supporting people's mental health. I've had positive and negative experiences of services I've worked in where they've handled that. But I would say that, again, you know, you're with a team of very experienced people, and the team comes together very quickly. Everyone's very very open, very quick to kind of make those social connections, you know, become, you know, very close friends. Those bonds that form that people talk about, and it almost happens without you knowing about it. You say good morning to somebody as you're getting, you know, going for your the morning brew or whatever, and you're getting on a truck with them, and then you have it, you know, an experience with them that day, and that's a massive bond formed. And yeah, I think that in itself, that kind of informal kind of debrief where you feel that psychological safety, where you can speak openly about things, you can reflect about the day we've just had, and you almost bounce off each other. And again, you know, the experience of being out there, you know, when we were going through villages, people are waving and shouting and cheering and smiling like that. It was quite strange how positive that was. You know, and we had people trying to give us things, and we're like, you know, you've got nothing. We're not taking stuff off you. Just that humanity, that generosity when people have got nothing, when they've been the victim of a disaster, and they're you know, still have this human empathy and kindness for you, coming from a first world country, you know, with all this kit and equipment, you know, we live, you know, in a tent for 10 days, we all get to go home to our families at the end of it, kind of thing. So, there was that side of it. When we came back, you know, there was officers supporting things like that, but, you know, I still speak to, many of the guys I was out there, you know, maybe once a month, twice a month, you know, over the phone, have a chat, go on trips, you know, etc. And I think that's important, because we've all had this experience, and it's quite difficult to relate that to other people, as I'm trying to do now. And even just, you know, you discuss how, I remember coming back one day and we'd been out for quite a while, came back, and one of the firefighters quite openly discussed how the day and the people that we'd saw, and especially the children that we saw, had made him feel, quite an emotional way, actually. And I remember being really kind of impressed, I suppose, being the word, because it was quite powerful, because it then made me speak to him about stuff, and that formed a really strong bond. So, you know, I think what we have to recognize, I think, as a culture, you know, healthcare professionals, rescuers, whatever, is that this is all a job, and we have lives and people and stuff going on outside of that. Whether that's, you know, the traffic on the way to work, or, you know, you didn't sleep very well or what, but we're all human before this. And then we take on all of this stuff. And, you know, we get described as heroes and superheroes, and you deserve a trophy and all of this. But we're not. We're human. And we have all this stuff in our own lives. We put that to one side and we come to work and we look after other people. And that's what we love to do. And that's what I love to do. And there is genuinely nothing, as cheesy as it sounds, there's nothing more rewarding for me than turn up to a scene and people being relieved that I'm there, dealing with that, and then getting them to a safe place, and them saying, and just even just the look on their face that everything's going to be all right now. That's genuinely the biggest reward for me in what I do. However, that, you know, I'm glad I get paid for what I do, because that's the world we live in, and you know, there's stresses outside of that. So taking all that stuff and not taking on a lot of stress. I don't know. I think there's a big kind of learning curve, and I'm certainly not at the top of it yet. So, in a rambling way, the psychological support, certainly from the team that was there, has been fantastic, because we have that bond and we talk to each other. And I think that culture was fostered right from the start. And I think that culture came from the leaders that were there. Every day we'd go to briefs and they would be very open about what was happening, open about how they were feeling, what was going on, saying thank you. And I think, especially in the UK, we're really good at, like, not accepting compliments and not celebrating things as much. I think other cultures are probably a little bit better than us at that. We kind of wear it as a badge of honour a little bit, but it was a positive experience in that sense.
So Jamie, just a few more questions before we come into land. One would be just how it's benefited you as a wider clinician. I know right now you work on a search and rescue asset, you know, as a winchman and indeed as a clinician in the UK. What have you brought back from the UK ISAR deployment and indeed the training into your day-to-day role?
I think it's changed me as a person, not just as a clinician. I think I've spoken to a few of those things, so I'm not going to ramble on about them again. I'm very open, where I will say things and ask questions, where as before I probably didn't as much. And I'll also recognise my own needs within that. So if I haven't slept very well and I'm tired, I will say to people, I didn't sleep very well last night, I'm quite tired. Whereas before, I would have just kind of gone with it. And I think that even that in itself is quite a big change for me personally. Sounds a bit silly. I think the other side of it is that we've got reams and reams of guidelines and, you know, rules that we work to and algorithms and procedures, and that's great, but translating them to real life isn't always perfect. And there was a real kind of shift in that. I can't provide perfect pre-hospital care as a paramedic, you know, in and saw it on the back of a ship somewhere, or in Morocco, or in the mountains. And there's that element of just sometimes we just have to get done what we can done, but we're going to have to, you know, make a plan and get this done, just what works, rather than trying to make, you know, make everything perfect. That's not saying, that's not speaking to dropping standards or anything like that, but it's about getting the job done, and they're getting the job done the best way you can, rather than, yeah, I think perfection is the enemy of the good, is what I'm trying to say. So that was certainly one thing. And yeah, I just think that that recognition of that, the being human's all right, and you can still, you do these things as a human. You don't have to be a superhero to go and respond to an earthquake or help somebody out. But it's not superheroes that do that. It's humans.
So just one or two more questions. One would be around the debrief, Jamie, and how did the debrief look? But also, was there any sort of psychological follow-up post-debrief? Did you find the debrief informative?
Yeah, so there was a bit of a debrief in country where we all got to kind of sit down, and it was almost like an independent kind of, this is what you know, you can speak to who you want to. You didn't work with everybody on the team. There was 60 odd people out there. But the people that you had worked closely with or had experiences with, there was debriefs daily, hot debriefs, but then a debrief kind of at the end, quite informally. It wasn't like a big meeting or anything like that. It was, you know, chat to each other, you know, there was time to do that. And it wasn't kind of, it was almost tacit. You went sat down in a room, you know, with a PowerPoint and stuff like that, and it was all very formalized. And I think, yeah, just giving us the signpost and the opportunity to do that, have discussion with each other, or keep in touch, or etc., was probably quite good, quite powerful. And I don't know whether that's a symptom of that's how those teams work back in the UK or what, but that was quite useful. And I think there was opportunities to feed into a cold debrief when we got back from our side of things. And as the UMT, we had a lot of debriefs as we went as well, which is useful, and reviewed, you know, I remember talking about your reviewing kit and how we would do things in the future, etc. Again, I took a lot of learning from that, rather than necessarily putting into it. Asked a lot of questions, because again, I am very new to this. So yeah, it was a good learning experience for me to see, you know, senior members of the UMT, how they discuss things and ideas and put things forward and changes, etc. So yeah, I think for me it worked quite well. I wouldn't say any more on that.
And just finally, Jamie, if someone's listening to this and wants to get involved within a search and rescue context, or indeed an international search and rescue context, I've heard you say in the past, you know, learn the skills at home, learn the trade in your backyard before you ever try and bring it into an international stage. But could you maybe speak to just a few messages you give to those who may aspire to join teams such as this?
So what I would say is that we went out there, and the first thing you've got to be able to deal with is that we lived in a tent for 10 days. Like, if you can live in a tent for 10 days in the UK, in the desert, it's easy because it's a very different environment. But it's about self-managing, you know, your space, your hygiene, your food, so that's what I would say, is that you have to have those basic skills that you can look after yourself, and look after yourself in the environment you're from first of all, and then the environment you want to go to, whether and train in that if at all possible. Then I would say you have to be able to do that as a you have to go into environments where you're going to operate. So, you know, responding to a village in the mountains, for me, my mountain rescue background really helped there. I understood that we were a long way from places and ambulances couldn't get here, etc. And, you know, the altitude aspects as well. There was, and just being far from help was a familiar feeling to me. So yeah, get used to being out. You're going to have more kit than the others. Not necessarily. Sometimes there's a heavy rescue going on. They'll have huge tools, but you know, you're the medics. You're always going to have a med kit. So there's an element of personal fitness there. There's an element of being the team player, not just necessarily a team player, but when you get back on the truck at the end, it's not just about sorting yourself out, it's about making sure everyone else has had some water. Has anyone got any cuts and bruises or anything, you know, is going on? Is everyone all right? And just watching and looking, because people won't tell you, especially, you know, people in rescue services were notorious for not telling you stuff or not disclosing things. So watching people, learning people's body language, speaking to people, not being shy, being quite gregarious in your teamwork, I would say. And then, yeah, being able to operate in that environment. So, you know, if you go into the mountains where it's going to be minus 20 and really cold, then you need to be able to manage yourself. And, you know, if you're losing your gloves and you're putting your kit down and losing things, then, like, that personal element, if you can't look after yourself, you can't look after somebody else. You really need to square that away before you can extend yourself to look after other people, especially 15 or 20 firefighters on a USAR team. And then, yeah, just be really confident and really good at your medicine. I think when you've got the confidence and the competence to do good medicine in that environment, then you've got the confidence to be able to deviate from guidelines where you need to, where actually, yes, I'd like to be able to do this, but I can't do that, so we're going to do this instead. And just having that rationale for your decisions and being able to have the confidence to discuss that as well. And then the biggest thing is just getting out there and pushing doors. I mean, I think you taught me that, Owen, was that just push doors and see what happens. And you find yourself in places you never thought you'd be. You've just got to get out there. You can do as many training courses in the world. Training's great, don't get me wrong. But at some point, you've just got to step out the door and go and have a go. And it's not at all easy. It's not at all straight line. It's not at all, you know, I never, until I applied to join the team, I'd never considered myself really doing humanitarian medicine. You know, my background is paramedic, you know, in SAR and in mountain rescue, that it wasn't a skill set that was necessarily needed there, but you know, you'll find your niche. So it's a fun journey.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I couldn't agree more, Jamie. Could not agree more. Listen, thank you for your time today. I really do appreciate it and your reflections as well.
Cheers, Owen. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the episode. Please feel free to rate, review and subscribe on whichever platform you're listening to. Please also head over to the World Extreme Medicine website, where you can find more engaging content on extreme medicine webinars and indeed the collection of courses from our global network, including humanitarian, disaster relief, expedition, space, military, tactical and performance medicine. Thanks again.